stories, Iran's president says efforts to neutralize sanctions against his country are not tied to negotiations with the P4 plus one group. Israel extends the imprisonment of a chronically ill Palestinian teenager under its much-criticized administrative detention policy. Also in the headlines, Britain's Prince Andrew is stripped of his military titles amid a sexual assault lawsuit against him in the U.S. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his administration is putting efforts to remove anti-Iran sanctions high on the agenda. In a tweet, President Raisi says the efforts to neutralize these sanctions are not tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. He says despite the existing sanctions, Iran is selling oil. Raisi says the sales have now increased to the level that no worries are left and the generated revenues are being returned to the country. Back in May of 2018, Iran was hit by rounds of sanctions that came into effect following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. Part of the measures hit the Iranian oil sector. Iran says the sanctions are illegal and it has the right to sell oil in international markets. Iran says countries under economic sanctions should strike up an alliance to counter the West's excessive demands. Iran's Vice President for Economic Affairs, Mohsen Rezaei, made the proposal during a meeting with Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. Rezaei noted that the two countries have been able to preserve their economic independence despite the sanctions. Ortega, for his part, hailed Iran, that is, for its resistance in the face of economic pressure the West exerts on the Islamic Republic. The Nicaraguan president was sworn in for his fourth term in office earlier this week amid criticism from the U.S. and the European Union. Israel extends the imprisonment of a chronically ill Palestinian teenager under its so-called administrative detention policy. The father of Amal Nakhle says his son will remain in detention for 4 more months. Amal has already been held for 1 year. The 17-year-old was arrested after throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. Amal has recovered from cancer surgery. He is now suffering from meiasthenia, a rare disease, I should say. The teenager is among minors held under Israel's administrative detention policy that allows for suspects to be detained without charge or trial. More than 450 Palestinians are held under that policy. The practice is widely criticized by international rights organizations. We've spoken to Mona Candil, she's our correspondent in the West Bank, to get more on the case of the Palestinian teenager.
The Israeli authorities claim that Amal Nakhle threw stones at the Israeli soldiers and at the nearby illegal settlement of Beit Ein. But clearly, there are no evidence. They couldn't present a charge with evidence, with eyewitnesses, to say that Amal Nakhle, according to them, is a criminal, throw stones at the full-armed Israeli forces and the fully armed Israeli settlers. Human rights organizations and experts continue to ask, what danger could Amal Nakhle be making for the Israeli authorities? So now Amal Nakhle would remain in jail for 4 months, but who knows, maybe the Israeli authorities, after the end of these 4 months, they can extend his detention as they do with other Palestinian prisoners. We are speaking today about some 500 Palestinians held under the so-called administrative detention amid international calls for Israel to either release them or prosecute them. And this detention pushed the Palestinians to go for hunger strikes.
South Korea and Japan say the North has conducted a new weapons test firing projectiles eastward. The two countries say North Korea used two short-range ballistic missiles in the latest test. Pyongyang has already carried out two tests of what it called hypersonic missiles in the past week. Following that, the U.S. imposed sanctions on five people linked to North Korea's ballistic weapons program. Sanctions are the first by U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, North Korea says. A measure is a provocation, and the U.S. is intentionally escalating the situation. Pyongyang says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. And now, the British Queen's second son, Prince Andrew, is stripped of his royal and military titles as he faces a U.S. civil case, that is, for sexual assault. According to British media, Prince Andrew will no longer be entitled to enjoy his Royal Highness title. The Buckingham Palace has also said the prince has given up his honorary military titles and charitable roles. That comes after more than 150 British veterans wrote to Queen Elizabeth calling on her to strip Andrew of his ranks and titles in the armed forces. The Duke of York is facing public outrage over his sexual misconduct. It denies any wrongdoing, but on Wednesday, a U.S. federal judge rejected an appeal over allegations that Andrew sexually assaulted a woman when she was 17. Virginia Giuffre accuses Andrew of assaulting her in 2001. Another blow to Boris Johnson's shaky premiership. Fresh reports say staff at the British Prime Minister's office partied on the eve of the socially distanced funeral of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. The UK-based Daily Telegraph says number 10 staff gathered on April the 16th last year for two separate leaving events. One was for James Slack, the Prime Minister's departing Director of Communications. Another one was for a personal photographer of Johnson. The events took place the day before Prince Philip was laid to rest. At that time, social gatherings were banned across the UK as part of COVID restrictions. Johnson himself was absent at those parties, but he is already facing calls to resign over several more parties held at Downing Street during lockdowns. Critics, including those from Labour, say Johnson is unfit to head the government and cannot be trusted. Five months into an energy crisis in the UK, a controversial blog post by one of the country's major energy suppliers has prompted a wave of outrage. It comes as average households face a sharp rise in their energy bills starting in spring, coupled with rising taxes and stalling wages. Our London correspondent Said Puraza reports.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Purizza, London.
After a short respite due to the coronavirus, a new report shows that the situation of asylum seekers on the western edge of Europe has become worse than ever. It comes on the heels of a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of the United Kingdom and France following the deadliest mass drowning on record in the English Channel late last year. Ramin Mazahiri has the full story.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received, don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Tensions heating up between Russia and the West. Moscow says sanctions against President Putin would mean a complete breakdown of ties. Kremlin spokesman has described as unsuccessful Wednesday's talks with NATO in Brussels. Separately, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the talks led to no progress and thus there is no need for further discussion in the coming days. The senior diplomat says the U.S. and its allies rejected Russia's key demands, including guarantees that NATO will not further expand eastwards. He has accused the West side or Western side of lacking flexibility and refused to rule out the possibility of Russian military deployment to Venezuela and Cuba in case of heightened tensions with the U.S. over Ukraine. In recent months, Moscow's ties with the West have taken a turn for the worse, with both sides warning about a new armed conflict in Europe. A general strike by the land transportation unions in Lebanon has led to a full closure in the country. Universities and schools were closed all over Lebanon and many people were not able to reach work. This comes as labor syndicates believe that the strike is a necessary step to put pressure on the government to press ahead with its promised reforms. Mariam Saleh reports from the Lebanese capital.
Public drivers, tanker trucks, and buses blocked major highways Thursday in Lebanon to protest the country's deteriorating economic and financial conditions. The head of the Land Transportation Union said they did not call for popular protests, since this is a first warning to the officials, after which there could be escalated steps.
We are here to voice support of the land transportation sector in their strike. We will continue till the end with this strike because the transportation sector does not only express the suffering of drivers, but also all the Lebanese living in these bad conditions.
The representatives of the drivers said had the government implemented its promises, there would not be a strike. With the fuel tank 10 times its price, with subsidies lifted and no benefits for workers in sight, all the people will once more take to the streets. One of the main crossroads in the heart of the capital, Beirut, has been blocked since 5 a.m. The Land Transportation Unions and the General Confederation of Lebanese Workers have said they will continue with their strike for days if need be, until their demands are met by the Mikati cabinet. This man says, "We are not alive, we are dead. People will learn not to vote for the same corrupt politicians," he says. These words are being heard frequently, only months preceding the parliamentary elections. The crisis goes beyond the price of fuel. The strike today is one facet of the economic meltdown, which has engulfed the country. Most people and even students have to take on multiple jobs to make ends meet.
We just want to live, we just want to eat, we just want to study. We've been deprived of our basic human rights. We're living in the country here today where our dollar used to be 1,500 Lebanese lira and now is 33,000. How are we supposed to live in situations just like these?
The nationwide protests were dubbed a day of rage, and with more than 80% of the Lebanese people living in poverty, it could be followed by more days of outrage at the political paralysis which has failed in stopping the socioeconomic and financial downfall. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And that's it with international news.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 22, 23, and 24 of Surah Tur.
وَأَمْدَدْنَاهُمْ بِفَاكِهَةٍ وَلَحْمٍ مِّمَّا يَشْتَهُونَ يَتَنَازَعُونَ فِيهَا كَأْسًا لَا لَغْوٌ فِيهَا وَلَا تَأْثِيمٌ ويطوف عليهم غلمان لهم كأنهم لؤلؤ مكنون.
We will provide them with fruits and meat, such as they desire. There they will pass from hand to hand a cup wherein there will be neither any vain talk nor sinful speech. They will be waited upon by youth, their own, as if they were guarded pearls. Might recall in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the rewards for the people of paradise will be both spiritual and material bounties. Paradise is the place of chastity, virtue, and morality, where men and women will be legally and lawfully bonded together in the sanctity of wedlock, and not any form of licentiousness. In Islam, faith is the base for building a virtuous family. Thus, the true believers will be joined by their virtuous spouses and offspring in paradise. The ayahs that we recited to you now proceed with an enumeration of the bounties which shall be bestowed upon the people of paradise, saying that the Almighty Creator provides whatever the people of paradise desire of meat and fruits, and they shall bear neither hardship nor affliction for obtaining them. Unlike our world, the fruits in paradise are not seasonal, but are available all the time. The people of paradise shall pass from hand to hand a cup brimming with a delightful drink that shall not take away reason, nor shall it lead to committing of vices. While reclining comfortably under luxurious couches, the people of paradise shall be served by most beautiful waiters resembling pearls in shells, which is a reference to their chastity and purity of purpose. These servants shall be exclusive for each and every person. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, paradise abounds with various fruits, healthy meats, and delicious drinks, the likes of which are not found in our world. And moreover, for the consumers, these bounties have no negative effects. Number two, in order to attain the reward of paradise, we should strive for virtue and repent of all our misdeeds, including vain talks and useless deeds, since in paradise such idle prattle does not exist. And number three, the delicious drinks of paradise are free of any intoxicants, while the waiters serving the people of paradise are a spotlessly pure youth whose virtue is beyond an iota of doubt. Now let us listen to ayahs 25, 26, 27, and 28 of the same surah.
وَأَقْبَلَ بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ يَتَسَاءَلُونَ قَالُوا إِنَّا كُنَّا قَبْلُ فِي أَهْلِنَا مُشْفِقِينَ فَمَنَّ اللَّهُ عَلَيْنَا وَوَقَانَا عَذَابَ السَّمُومِ إِنَّا كُنَّا مِنْ قَبْلُ نَدْعُوهُ إِنَّهُ هُوَ الْبَرُّ الرَّحِيمُ.
The people of paradise will turn to one another, questioning each other. They will say, "Indeed, aforetime we used to be apprehensive about our families, but Allah showed us favor and He saved us from the punishment of the infernal miasma. Indeed, we used to supplicate Him aforetime. Indeed, He is the All Benign, the All Merciful." These ayahs are indicative of the eternal bliss enjoyed by the people of paradise who are always thankful to God Almighty. And while associating with one another, they will recount how their obedience of the Lord Most High has removed all anxieties, including their utmost care in guiding their families on the right path, and thus saved them from divine punishment. The people of paradise acknowledge the reality of the Almighty Creator's grace, benevolence, and mercy, for which they used to pray in the transient world. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Paradise and hell are the results of one's own deeds. And of course, the all-merciful Lord, who has given us ample respite in the world, is always ready to forgive the penitents and shower them with all bounties. Number 2. A believer is always concerned of guiding his or her family on the right path and grooming children to be obedient to God Almighty. And number 3, the people of paradise are grateful to the Lord Most High and consider the bliss granted to them as divine favor rather than mere recompense for their paltry virtuous deeds. Now we invite you to listen to Ayah 29 and 30 of Surah Tur in conclusion of this week's episode.
فَذَكِّرْ فَمَا أَنْتَ بِنِعْمَةِ رَبِّكَ بِكَاهِنٍ وَلَا مَجْنُونٍ أَمْ يَقُولُونَ شَاعِرٌ نَتَرَبَّصُ بِهِ رَيْبَ الْمَنُونِ.
O prophets, admonish the disbelievers. By your Lord's blessing, you are not a soothsayer, nor mad as they allege. Do the disbelievers say, "He is a poet for whom we await a fatal accident"? These ayahs, after recounting the blessings of paradise, addresses Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God Almighty commands the Prophet to remind the disbelievers of their duty and to warn them of the consequences of their misdeeds, including their vile accusations of calling the Prophet a soothsayer, a madman, or a poet. The Prophet is the messenger of God to mankind, and his mission is guidance towards the path of monotheism and virtue. God protects the Prophet, so stop dreaming of any untoward accident happening to him. From these ayahs we'll learn that, number 1, it is a habit of the opponents of the Prophets to try to belittle them by calling them names and accusing them of madness in a vain bid to prevent people from being guided to the path of God. And number two, the enemies of Islam desire to see the end of Islam and wish harm for the prophets, the imams, the saints, and virtuous religious leaders, but their devilish dreams and their plots will never be materialized, since God is the Almighty Protector.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States' assessment of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been problematic since the victory of Iran's revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reiterated the U.S.'s miscalculations regarding Iran. He said Washington thought with its terror assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani that all of his efforts would have been in vain. But the reality, he says, is that the opposite is true. The committed people of Iran are following and continuing his way more now than ever before. So at the end of the day, what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on The Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight out of Berkeley, Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator. and Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome you both to the program. Well, let's start this off in Berkeley. And Paul, your overall assessment, what is it all about, Paul? There's so much animosity that comes from Washington towards Tehran that even started, even leading up to the revolution, even before the revolution miscalculation. What is it all about in your perspective?
Marcia, I think there is what you can call a more global view and also a very short-term view. The situation actually at the time of General Soleimani's assassination was that, let's say, there was an opportunity that was spotted by the military, saying an opportunity for assassination, that is. And it means that they were, of course, watching his movements and preparing for the possibility of assassination. And the short-term view is that they presented that to Trump and to President Trump, and President Trump saw it as an opportunity for him. That is to say, he was not being presented very well in the press, and he decided that an assassination like this, regardless of its actual strategic value, would boost him in the polls and make him appear to be a hero, or at least become a hero in the press, if you will, on a very short-term basis. And he took it. He wanted the glory, if you will, as the United States would see it. But there is another...
Hey, Paul, what exactly does that mean? I mean, you say that basically he took the bait. He decided that's what he wanted. He wanted the glory. But the system in the U.S. is not really individual-based as such. Wouldn't you say, there's something extremely problematic, to say the least, about an entity that sits down and thinks that, oh, okay, so assassinating this general representing another country on a diplomatic mission is actually an opportunity. I mean, let's look at that side of things and what we're saying about that entity.
Well, that's the other side of what I was going to mention. That is to say that there's a larger picture, but on balance, it's very possible that, there were equal sides on the issue within Washington's and the Pentagon's calculating as to whether they should do it or not. But the side that had a, let's say, a more calculating and long-term view realized that General Soleimani was a problem for the United States because he was eliminating the terror threat in the Middle East, and because he had negotiated with Putin and was important in persuading Putin to join the fight in Syria in a limited way at that time. And because he unified forces in the region and the views, and because he had the respect of all of that, and so in that sense, they wanted him out of the way for these reasons.
Okay, stay with me, Paul. Yeah. Let me get Elijah in this conversation. Elijah, in the early days of Iran's revolution, Washington continued to say that Imam Khomeini was going to die any day, and after he would die, then the revolution basically would be over. And we've seen so many different types of miscalculations along the way. And, of course, with the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. I want to talk about that aspect, that it really expected the resistance in the region to be stunted now, to be impeded or to go in another direction. By assassinating him. Of course, he was a very, very important figure. But as the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said today, with his assassination or his martyrdom, actually, support for the resistance has grown.
Thank you for having me. I think what really happened is we can't exclude the ignorance of President Trump and the team he had around him to inform him that removing or assassinating General Qasem Soleimani would deter the access of the resistance, would weaken Iran, because everything is related to one man and one man only. And that's pure ignorance, really, because the access of the resistance is made of several population who have decided to fight against the U.S. hegemony and dominance, and they want the U.S. forces outside of their country. Now, that is not depending on one man. It is the ideology, it is the country, it is the principle, and it is the fight behind the cause and not behind one single man. And when President Donald Trump assassinated Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the Daesh emir, he thought that Qasem Soleimani could be more or less the same thing at the same level, and he can get rid of him like he did with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi without soliciting any reaction. And what he did in a moment when the color revolution was starting to pick up a little bit in Iran, where people in the street were destroying banks and official institutions, creating havoc in the country, burning gasoline stations, etc. And the Americans, with their limited thinking, they thought we can create more, we can give more boost to this movement of the population that the Americans are behind, and we can cripple more Iran and submit it so it accept the U.S. dominance, and it, at the end of the day, it aligns itself for what we want. This is why Donald Trump imposed maximum pressure on Iran to cripple the population and submit Iran. So by assassinating unlawfully an envoy of Iran and an advisor to the Iraqi government in Iraq, in Baghdad, he thought that he can get away with it and it would be a simple act. He didn't realize that Qasem Soleimani boosted a new blood in the revolution in Iran, because we saw millions of people in Iran, but also we saw millions of people in Iraq. And that also helped the axis of the resistance to remember who is the enemy, and that the U.S. should be removed from the area, because the only thing it is doing is just killing, particularly a general who was the main force behind defeating ISIS in the Middle East.
What about that, Paul? I mean, Elijah said that there's ignorance there, especially dealing with Trump and those around him. But we're not just talking about the 4 years that Trump was president. We're talking about more than four decades of miscalculation in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is that about? I mean, what exactly does that mean? We have many strategists, all kinds of think tanks in Washington and beyond. So your assessment of it.
Thank you. That's right on point, Marzia. And Elijah is absolutely right. There's one side of it that's based on ignorance. And it's being used by people in the state and adjacent to the state, who are the deep state, you could say, that are using this ignorance for their own purposes. And those purposes are partly, in fact, in large measure, the purposes, the Zionist purposes of the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But it's also part of and allied to a deep state that wants to impose by military force its domination of other countries, and other countries which are currently dominated by the United States and which have puppet regimes of the United States installed there are sort of left alone. They're not, you don't see the U.S. Destroying those countries except by exploitation. But the other ones, which insist on being independent, and Iran is certainly a nation that wishes to remain independent, as does Syria and Iraq and Venezuela and North Korea and Nicaragua and Cuba and on and on. There are these that are considered problem states, problem countries that the United States has to deal with. And what the policy towards those countries has been, and still is, that these countries have to be taught a lesson. And at the very least, they have to be destroyed. If they won't submit, then they have to be destroyed as an example to other countries as to what happens to them. So this, and this is very much part of the Zionist thinking, which benefits the State of Israel by using the U.S. military to fight the perceived enemies of Israel. So those interests are very much allied with each other, and that's not a case of ignorance. This is a case of very deliberate use of military force, economic force through sanctions, so-called sanctions, and destruction. And this is a theory of how the United States can continue to remain in power throughout the world.
Well, Elijah, continuing on that theme, I mean, do you think that it is because of a lack of understanding about Iran that there still is so much animosity and the actions that are taken against Tehran? Or is it actually because they have a very, very good understanding of Iran and the possibilities of Iran and its support, not only support for the resistance, but actually being the leader of the resistance?
I can't say that the U.S. has a good understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, because we saw what the Americans did in Afghanistan after 20 years. We saw what they are doing in Iraq. They were asked to leave in 2011, and now they are asked and will be forced to leave. We saw what they've done in Syria. They're occupying a part of Syria, and they don't know what to do, to remain or to leave, and they really can't figure out what's the best solution. We see what they are doing in Lebanon. And yes, I agree with your guest about the element of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu at the time when Donald Trump wanted the support of the Israelis in his re-election. And actually, Donald Trump blamed Israel for not going to war against Iran. Well, the Israelis are much more clever than the Americans at that time, because they know what the cost of a military confrontation with Iran, and what would be the consequences and the cost. Well, I think the Americans, everything they have done in the last decade was a total failure. From the beginning, when they say we're going to Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, they haven't been able to do that. to destroy Taliban. They negotiated with the Taliban, who are back in power. They say in Iraq they want the weapon of mass destruction, but they have managed to contribute in the rise of a resistance that is part of the axis of the resistance that was directed its strength and its attack against the U.S. forces. Now in Syria, it's picking up. In Lebanon, they were kicked out in the 80s, and now they're trying to come back with the sanctions. So I don't see any clever policy of the U.S. apart from an elephant in a China shop just breaking left, right, and center, and then leaving without even saying, I'm sorry, and say, well, what I have destroyed is only the consequences and of what I have done, and you can live with it, because there is no accountability. This is why the Americans can do what they are doing, because they fear and consider no, they have no consideration to international law, and they have no consideration to any law whatsoever, because there is no accountability.
Well, Paul, your take on what Elijah said as far as the United States not having any accountability, I want to look at overall how this miscalculation, whether we're talking about with Iran or Afghanistan or Lebanon or Syria or so many examples that Elijah just brought, what has it done to the United States itself?
Well, I don't think you'll find many people in Washington that will admit to a miscalculation, and that includes the think tanks and the part of Washington that studies very carefully what's going on and so forth. But there's a lot of disagreement between the forces in Washington, and there's also a lot of arrogance. So you and I may call it a failed policy, but the
if we just take Afghanistan, I mean, 20 years and how much money spent and leaving the way they did, I find even very few Americans would say that was successful policy that they adhered to in Afghanistan with the results if we look at it.
Yes, that's what they would say, but that's not what they say in Washington. What they say in Washington is that this is time well used, because the influence of what's going on in Afghanistan, it gave them a presence in the Middle East, and it pushed and it gave a warning to adjacent countries, don't mess with us, and all this kind of thing. This is the way they think. This is what I'm telling you. I'm not saying it's a good way of thinking. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that this is the so-called expertise that they have there, and they would say, yes, we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve in Iraq, but on balance, it's still very useful. And as long as there's war going on and there's a war economy in the United States and the United States can destroy anybody on the face of the earth, we're in a good situation. That's the kind of thinking you're dealing with.
Okay. Well, Elijah, we just have about 1 minute. Your overall assessment, I mean, the United States, especially after the assassination of General Soleimani, many would say that the reputation, whatever was left of it, has deteriorated rapidly. Your analysis of the United States right now in the region compared to prior to the assassination, how it has deteriorated and where do you see it going from here?
I think the assassination of Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani brought something new to the Middle East. Soleimani's death is more to be feared by the U.S. than when he was alive. And I think this has raised the awareness to so many people about what the Americans are doing in the area, in the Middle East, and what they are capable of, and how they think they can do whatever they want. And people are working to push the Americans outside the Middle East now as soon as is possible. And we see what's happening today in Iraq, where they are attacked every single day, just for the Iraqi to make a point and say to the Americans, just leave us alone. We can sort out our problems without your presence.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here. Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator out of Berkeley. Elijah McNeil, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us right here.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us two very, very special guests. On my right, we have Sister Asma. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
And on my left, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam and assalamu alaikum from my end.
Sister Zainab, I've met you before, I've worked with you before, but could you give a brief introduction to about yourself? I mean, who are you? Where have you come from?
I am Zainab Askari. I am from the Indian occupied Kashmir, and I'm like done with masters in linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I came to Iran. It's been 7 years I'm here. I am studying Hausa right now.
Uh-huh. So linguistics, you're going to be dealing with like...
the rules of translation, phonetics, syntax, okay, morphology, what we do in like surf and stuff.
Ah, you're my teacher then. Sister Asma, is it? Where are you from? Who are you?
Well, I am from Iran. And I study English literature.
I studied English literature, really?
That's very good.
Oh,
me
no
too.
Way. So you're studying Shakespeare and...
yes, a lot of poetry, novels, poetry, plays, mm-hmm, and that's my favorite thing to do.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Okay, yes. So today, I'd like to actually open up the discussion by talking a little bit about how social media, as we know, has taken over a lot of our lives. It's changed the way that the world works.
Yes.
But now there's a brand new spanner in the works, and it goes by the name of the metaverse.
Yes.
I don't really know much about it. What is the metaverse exactly?
Just for a start, in order to make it clear, the concept tells that it's a set of virtual 3D spaces where you can create your own zone. Now, if we want to make it more clear, imagine a parallel world to this world that we're already living in. Imagine that you have the ability to create another world of your own. Then you would be whatever you want, travel wherever you want, do different things, experience new things, and you're sitting in your place. It's like you're an armchair traveler. Like you do everything and you're in your own place. Right?
So what's the difference between that and video games? There's lots of really cool open world video
games.
Well,
a very big difference. Mm-hmm. By the use of some special glasses or perhaps some gloves and headsets, you're going to be completely in that environment. For example, if you are going to go to a jungle, imagine yourself in a jungle. You're going to put those glasses on your eyes and then you would pick that jungle and then you go into it and then you would feel the atmosphere in there, if it's cold, if it's warm, if it's rainy, if it's not rainy. And you're going to touch things even. That's going to be a more of a 3D sort of a experience.
Wow. So it's actually physically interactive now.
Yes, very. It's a tremendous experience.
Whoa. And have you experienced it yet?
Not, of course, uh-huh, not yet.
Not yet. Wow. Okay, so have you guys seen The Matrix?
Yes, Matrix.
The Matrix,
I've
right?
Seen.
So it's pretty much that. They're
yes,
creating a world within
sort
the real
of that
world.
Way. Yes.
So the Holy Quran actually says the life of this world is nothing but play.
Yes.
But what they're actually creating, which is really terrifying, is a dunya within the dunya.
Yes, that is very nice expression. To put it that way, it would be very nice. I told you, a parallel world, as if you're having two identities.
Luminate.
And the thing is that whatever you create in that world, for example, I go to that world, I create a new character of my own, and I would call that an avatar.
Mm-hmm.
That would be called an avatar. So whatever you want, for example, I would love to be an astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would experience how an astronaut is doing,
mm-hmm,
very clearly that way.
Here we go. We'll be right back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that